Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. We're here with the one and only Chris Traynor. Chris is a phenomenal guitar player. He's an American guitarist and songwriter. He started his career in his teens, founding the seminal post-hardcore band Orange 9mm, and he continued on playing bass and guitar in the alternative metal band Helmet. In late 2001, Chris joined the British rock band Bush, and he's been performing with Bush and Gavin Rossdale since that time. That's 18 years, man. Over his 25-plus-year musical career, Chris has performed with a diverse group of musical artists live, including the Britpop band Blur, and he's recorded with Katy Perry, Peter Green of Fleetwood Mac, Gavin Rossdale, and Rival Schools. Man, what a diverse Orange 9mm to Katy Perry, man. That is unique.
Well, I'm pretty lucky. Hey, man, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. How's it going?
Thank you so much. It's going great, man. I really appreciate your time. So, man, talk about Orange 9mm. They were a very good band, and I know, like, they were classified as hardcore. I never thought of you guys as hardcore. To me, you were more like Beastie Boys meets desert rock or stoner rock, you know? And I just had some questions. They were really popular in New York City. So the questions are, how'd you get hooked up with Chaka Malik? Did I say his name right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then, I think you played bass and guitar back then. Why was that?
I met Chaka. So Chaka was in a pretty important New York hardcore band called Burn. They were a great band. And when I first moved to the city, I went to see them play. He was one of the most dynamic hardcore front people that I've ever seen. And I remember seeing him come out on stage, and he brought an axe out on stage, like a little like hand axe. And I was like, who is this guy? And I met him. He worked at a health food store a couple of blocks away from me. I think the health food store was called Prana, and a bunch of people in the hardcore scene worked there. And I walked in and I introduced myself to him, and we got to sitting together and playing music. I actually learned a lot about music from Chaka. And when we started the band, it was just him and I, and we would sit in, he had this tiny studio apartment on 6th Street by all the Indian restaurants, and it was the winter time, and there was steam heat in there at the time. And I remember the steam heat was kind of putting me down a little bit, you know. In
the winter time. Gross. I'm assuming this is the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And we would just sit there, try to write music. So, he placed really great emphasis on the bass, and, was playing me, all sorts of different music that he had grown up with. So a lot of that music was written from the standpoint of the bass. And then I put, which I think in some way, even though I really like the riffs and a lot of that stuff is cool, made the guitar suffer because I put so much energy into the bass. And then him and I worked on what the drums would sound like, that the guitar would come at the end. And even though I think there's a lot of cool guitar parts on that stuff, I think, had I mostly been, well, who knows what would happen. So yeah. Anyway, I wrote from the standpoint of the bass with him because the bass was really important. He showed me the importance of the bass.
Very cool. What made you move to the city?
A girl.
Fair enough, man. Imagine that. Yeah. That was, you know, it's so funny, man. You know, the Lower East Side, when you were there, you probably got like the last breath out of the dinosaur, because it's nothing like, I don't know if you've been back in the last 10 years, man, but it's totally different.
I mean, when I was there, there were like rioting about closing Tompkins Square Park, and right. Like people, you know, it was a different, It was a totally different time. I mean, it's to me, when I go to New York now, it's unrecognizable.
Yeah, especially that area. You know, like Bleecker Street used to be my favorite street, and now you walk down there, it's all like high-end, you know, purses and tech, little gadgets store. I mean, it's just a lot different. You know, I miss the old New York in many ways.
I miss it too. I mean, the thing I really miss about it was that you have a little bit still left in LA is that the mom and pop stores, like you go into a store to buy like a magazine and you kind of get a relationship with the people that owned it, or even like going into a bodega, like coffee shop, like they'd know your name. They'd know how you like your coffee. You'd have a conversation with them. A cab driver would walk in and you'd know him too. And it was just like more of a mix up of people, where now it seems that there's the income inequality seems to be highlighted now for me. But maybe that's because I don't live there anymore. Maybe it was always like that.
No, it was never like that at all. It's not, it's because we've gone back. I mean, I grew up in the Bronx, and so we've gone back many times, and we were just there a couple of months ago, my wife and I, but it's changed a lot. And it seems like one of the things you just mentioned, the income, and I don't want to spend too much time in New York when I talk about you, but it is a big shift because the people that live there, they're either young kids, mom and dad is supporting them, or they're, you know, maybe not from the city. There's a lot of out of country people living there and someone else is supporting them. It seems I missed that program, man. I would have liked to have been on one of those programs, you know, where someone was supporting you, not just like supporting you to like, you know, at a baseline apartment in the Lower East Side, but in a condo in the Shishi Soho or something like that. That is always, that's always interesting to me. I don't know how that works, but
we all have our own path.
Yeah, man. I hear that. Okay, so you hooked up with Chaka, you wrote stuff, and then you just got right into the music scene down there. You were playing at CBGBs, and I imagine stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, built on, like, Chaka had done a lot of the groundwork, so, like, his band was popular. So when we came out, people wanted to see us. And when we started playing, like, the first we had done a record before we play our first show. We'd done an EP with Don Fury, who at that time was like the, you know, the legend, punk rock, hardcore guy. And we had the opportunity to record with him in his basement in Little Italy. And, we started playing shows, and there was so much buzz about the band actually that we played these small places and people couldn't get in to see us. And we got, because of that, we got signed after our third show to a major label.
Crap. Wow.
And it was interesting because I still remember this. I still remember the thrill that I felt. Nobody knew who I was, so I walked in to Bleecker Bob's to try to find our record because I couldn't believe my record was going to be in Bleecker Bob's.
Yeah, man.
And I said, "Do you have the Orange 9mm record?" And he said, "No, we sold out of that. You know, and you know, you should get it if you can, because rumor is those guys had gotten signed." So people were like talking about us before we had done anything based on like it, you know, based on hype. I think that the band had substance, but really like people were driven crazy by it. Like there were record company people that tried to get into our show that weren't allowed in, and I just rubbed them the wrong way. And then they wanted to sign the band even more.
Wow. So how did you feel when you walked into Bleecker Bob's, which I don't think is around anymore. And you're like, my records was sold out. What were you feeling when you heard that?
I still haven't forgotten it. It's just like one of the highlights for me, because as a kid, when you take trips into New York City and see this like famous record store within a genre of records, and then to go in there and they know who your band is, to me, that was like everything.
Yeah. Very cool, man. That's such a good story. What was overall the music scene in New York back like then?
You know, there was this roots of like hardcore that I really dipped in towards the end. I was just going to shows. I have friends that were there from the beginning. Well, whatever the beginning of like the more 80s bands. So they really were more responsible for the do-it-yourself groundwork and doing the shows and creating a scene. And when I got there, bands were starting to break out when I started playing, bands were starting to break out of that, trying to break out of that mold of being hardcore, quote unquote. So bands like Quicksand were starting, and DC bands were kind of coming up, a band called Shudder to Think. So there was people reaching out and trying to express themselves. And I thought it was a really interesting time because to me it felt, I mean, if you look back on music, you can kind of tell where it comes from and where it ended up going. But for me at the time, seeing, being around people and these bands and watching them kind of like grow was amazing because it felt mysterious. Like I remember hearing the first Quicksand LP before it come out, and there wasn't vocals on it at first, you know, that's the way it was recorded. And I remember listening to it going like, my God, this is amazing. Like, and just thinking like how exciting it was. Seattle was a thing that was huge at the time, and people were looking for New York to be the next Seattle. And it was amazing to be around that kind of creativity.
That's awesome, man. You left, though. You wound up leaving Orange 9mm after the third album to join Helmet. What was going on? Like, what were your thoughts about that decision and leaving the band?
It was, we did an EP and two records, and two long play records, if that, you know, if people even understand what that term is, LPs. But before the, I left before the second record even came out. Because, I mean, honestly, I've never talked about this, but it was frustrating for me. There was, I felt like I wasn't doing a good job at expressing myself and expressing that band at that point. I remember taking our demos to the record label, and they were saying stuff like, you should put African string instruments on it. And I just thought, like, that's ridiculous. Like, it's such a Artie Fufkin kind of like Polymer Records thing to say. And just being frustrated by the process and feeling trapped. And I knew that there would be an opportunity. Like, I had met Dave Sardi at that time. We were doing that record, and he was encouraging me to just kind of branch out and play with different people. And I become friends with Paige Hamilton, and there was an opening in Helmet, and I just thought, this is like the opportunity for me to just like ditch. I mean, I kind of like feel bad in a way because I think I left those guys high and dry. They ended up doing okay without me. Not like they needed me to get by, but I just felt like I wanted to be in a band where I was just the guitar player and I didn't have to think about like carrying a ship in a certain direction and writing for a while. And that was great because in Helmet, there was no way that I was going to come in and start writing for them.
Right. Right. So it was just like too much too soon, or.
I just thought really when we first started doing that first record, I thought we had an opportunity to do something, and we were around early with Korn, and we were around early with the Deftones, and we were like Orange 9mm, Korn, and the Deftones were some of the really kind of more progressive metal slash, even the Deftones was a little bit hip hop in the beginning, and they were doing a really good job of it. And I had realized that it wasn't my thing. Like, that wasn't who I was. And so I didn't want to have to think about it. I wanted to still play music, but I couldn't think about it anymore. And I didn't want to have to carry the creative weight of trying to, not that it was all mine. Chaka contributed so much, but I didn't feel like I could do it. So I just wanted to be a guitar player for a little while.
That's pretty, that's a tough decision to make. I give you credit for doing that because it's, you know, you really had to evaluate. Yeah, had to have a, you know, those quote, come to Jesus meeting with yourself about, you know, what do you really like? And then, you know, is what you're doing congruent with who you are, which is always a very tough decision to make, especially got other people involved there that, you know, and I'm sure you guys are really super tight.
It felt bad.
I'm sure.
It felt like I was really kind of like, you know, it felt like a bad breakup. Like, you know, when you have to, like, when you love somebody, but you know you can't be with them, that's what it felt like.
Yeah, yeah. No, I totally get it. But, you know, in the reality, the pain of staying, you know, the short-term pain of breaking up would, you know, would pale in comparison to the long-term pain of sticking around there and continuing to make music that you're not into. So, yeah. I mean, you made the right decision. But, yeah, that's tough, man. Thank you for sharing that. That was that's cool. So you join Helmet, which I have this album, Aftertaste. Great freaking album. It was funny. I hadn't listened to it in a while. And when I was putting your questions together, I listened to the album because I thought it was like of all the bands out there and of all the albums that you were involved with, was Aftertaste. I was like, wow, you know, it just was weird to me that I happened to, you know, I dig that record and I have it because I really wasn't like a hardcore guy or, you know, per se. But the band broke up shortly after that.
Yeah.
What?
That was a drag.
Yeah, I would imagine. God, my question was that I would imagine that's disappointing. What happened? Like, what were you thinking? If you could share without like being gossipy, I'm not looking at that, but what happened with the breakup and what did you wind up doing musically after that?
Well, I joined that band. Those guys were all such great players. Henry, John, and Paige. And Paige and I are still good, really good friends. I love those other guys. It's not like, you know, I have something against them, but they had a band dynamic that was going on for a long time. And I'd come in and I didn't really understand it like socially, you know, and I was like a codependent puppy dog that was trying to like lick everybody's faces and make everybody feel good about what was going on. And it was just such a great band. It was such a natural fit for me, I thought. And I had a lot of fun. All I had to do was like play guitar. But the vibe between those guys wasn't great. You know, it was interesting because it was the same for them, I think. Like, the vibe wasn't going on. They couldn't fully appreciate and grasp what they had going for them, and it didn't seem worth it to them. That's my outside view of it. You know, because I was way younger than most of those dudes. So yeah. I was like a kid in that band, and I remember the last tour we were doing, I knew it was over. Like, it wasn't said, but you could feel that. And I remember sitting in a hotel room with in Manchester, you know, like
Manchester, like England, or Manchester, New Hampshire?
Manchester, England.
Yeah.
With like a guitar, like looking at it in my hotel room and like crying. Yeah. Because I was like, man, I have to rethink this thing. I can't do this anymore. Like, I can't, you know, I've just been in two bands that have been like doing the drop D, like kind of heavy thing. And you just can't like keep milking that, although people wanted to. And I was like, I felt lost. And then at the end of that tour, like, I remember the last show we played was, I think, in Rimini, Italy. But I do remember that the crowd wanted an encore and those guys didn't go out for an encore. And I couldn't believe it because they were over it.
They were so done.
They were so done. And it was really like heartbreaking for me because it was such a great band and I loved playing with them. And then it really kind of made it so that, but that really forced me out into the world. Like, as a musician, I couldn't just sit back and coast playing really cool drop D riffs with somebody and just hiding. It really forced me to I guess pick myself up by my bootstraps in a way.
Hmm. So what was the takeaway, or what was the lessons learned from your experience with these alternative New York bands, or what did New York itself even teach you professionally or personally?
I think New York is a hard place to be an artist. There's a lot of great art that comes out of New York, and there's a lot of great musicians, but my feeling about New York, which I love, and I just so appreciate having been able to come through it, is that New York is super intellectual and hypercritical. So it's hard to...
It is, man. It's hard to make people happy.
It's hard to get ideas out. It's hard to be around people that, like, you know, every riff you play, they're like, oh, that sounds too much like this. And I just thought... Also, you know... Interestingly, I don't know if this is connected, but when I moved out of New York and I wasn't around the people that I grew up with or the scene, of music and musicians that I had been around, I had to decide for myself. I'm like, oh, wait a second. What do I like? And when you're outside of a community of people that, like, sometimes, I think a lot of times we base what we like based on how we're going to be perceived within our community or what community that we want to be a part of. I think that's goes across the board, not just with music, but like the way we dress, politics, all that kind of stuff. And so for me, when I came out here, I realized I hadn't largely been making choices based on what I liked. In fact, I didn't even know what I liked. So,
which is pretty reasonable for, I mean, how old were you at the time?
I had been coming out here for a while. When I started working with Gavin, he started flying me out here, and I would spend like 2-3 months at a time, like renting a place out here. So, you know, I've been coming out here since as long as I worked with Gavin. So maybe like 18 years.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you were a kid then too. It's hard to know. I give you a lot of credit for even having that thought process. It's hard to even have that thought process when you're that age.
I was forced to though. That's what I think. Yeah. It was like a blessing. You know, you get kicked out and you're like, you know, you go from having like a record deal where somebody gives you a big fat check as a teenager, and then like basically not having a job. You know what I'm saying? So you're just like, which is a, you know, this is the most common story in music, actually. You know, like where people are just like, most people can't make a living, you know, and it's not based on talent or drive or anything like that. It's based on a combination of all those. So that's, I'm not complaining, but I really kind of was out there and felt lost. I was like, what am I going to do? Like, how am I going to, so an interesting thing that if I'm not rambling, I could say was that
you're not,
when I was after Helmet broke up, I tried to start a band and I thought I'll be the singer and I'll write the music and, I'll do it the right way. You know, like when you're a kid, you think you know the right way to do things. And I had a real hard time finding anybody that was good enough to play the music that I wanted to play that didn't think that they were good enough to be like the singer or the main guy either. So I decided then to be who the person I was looking for another person.
So hold on a second. Let me just process that. You decided to be the person you were looking
for another person.
Okay, so you decided to be the support guy that you wanted for someone else.
That's correct.
Okay. What made you come to that decision? Just the sheer frustration of trying to find you, basically.
I mean, I just think it's like, can you imagine if like George Harrison was like, you know, like I'm really good, but I don't want to, you know, like I want to be in my own band. Like it seems like back in the day, like everyone in the band was really good. And then, so anyway, I just wanted to use my talents to facilitate someone else's dream, like kind of like someone else's music to like push that forward, to push forward what they were going to do. Because I guess in a way, I'm just realizing this now is because I still was, at that point kind of confused about who I was. I knew I had talent and I knew I had good ideas, but I guess I didn't really know what specifically I wanted to do. So I said this, I should just again, like use my talent to be dedicated to somebody else's music.
Good for you, man. And then, so how did you wind up getting connected with Gavin and Bush?
Because I'd met Dave Sardi doing the Aftertaste record, and he came out and toured with us in Helmet, and he had said to me that he had thought that I was one of the best live rock guitar players he'd ever seen, which was a huge compliment.
That's huge, man.
And I think that's not just based on technical skills. That's like, you know, that's something more than that, because there are way better rock guitar players than me. But and so I met a girl, had fallen in love. I was gonna quit music. I quit music actually. I still played for myself. And we were going to start like some hippie commune out somewhere, or like live off the land out of the back of a Volkswagen bus and have a baby. And she got pregnant. I got her pregnant, and it didn't kind of work out like that. We moved to Virginia, and I just wasn't doing anything. I was giving guitar lessons, and I was faux painting mansions, which is and we went up to New York for a Rick Rubin's birthday party. My girlfriend's friends were Rick Rubin, and Dave Sardi was there. He's like, "Hey, what are you doing?" I was like, "Nothing." He's like, "You're not playing in the band or anything?" I'm like, "No." He's like, "I might have a gig for you." Just holy like crap. Randomly at like a party. So I was like, "Cool." And then I was like, "Who are you working with right now?" And he said Slayer. So I thought, "Oh shit, I'm going to get to play guitar in Slayer. That's so awesome."
Yeah. That was funny. One day I'm faux painting mansions, and the next day I'm playing with Slayer.
Yeah. But it awesome. wasn't true. You know, he gave me I had given him my phone number of where I was, and I was waiting for a phone call, and it didn't happen. So like after I think 2 or 3 weeks, I was just like, "Oh, you know, that whatever that was, it's not happening." And I get a phone call. Guy picks up. He's like, "Is Chris there?" He has an English accent. And I said, "Yeah, who's this?" And he said, "Gavin." And I didn't know who it was. And I said, I'm sorry, who is this?" And he said, "Gavin Rossdale." And I was like, "Oh man, hey, how's it going?" So I was completely taken by surprise, because right. I didn't realize that I was going to get a call from Gavin.
That's kind of wild. These are pretty wild stories, man. It's like, you know, and this is not uncommon in music, as you know. It's like one day I was a maintenance guy, and the next week I was on tour in England.
Yeah.
It's like, what, you know, the change of destiny within very short scopes of time is not uncommon, you know?
Yeah. Always keep a bag packed. That's what I say.
Yeah, man. So, and then he said, "Hey, come out," or you auditioned, or what, how did that work?
I auditioned. I went out, and he wasn't even there, which is the same thing that actually interestingly happened with Helmet. Like Paige was like, "I like you. Like if the guys in the band are cool with you, or you can be in Helmet." And with Gavin, he was just like, "Come out and play with the band." And I did.
He wasn't there.
Yeah, that was pretty uncomfortable, actually.
Because you didn't know anybody.
I didn't know anybody, and I would just feel like, you know, I'm a sensitive person. I feel like I was getting vibed out, you know, like there's a whole crew and a band there that are like a family, and you're not part of the family. You're just a new guy. And of course, when you come into a band, I've had the experience. In fact, I've made a career out of like coming into bands that I didn't start. Like there's always this thing where, the other guy did this, like, you know, maybe you can do this nice. Or whatever. It's just like, you know, imagine if you were making love to a woman or your partner.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
and
yeah.
You're like, "You know what I really like? I like this.
The other guy did this. The other guy did this." Yeah. So it's like about blowing your, take the wind out of your sails.
Gets into your head a little bit. You know, it was interesting too, like, because I had to have that experience, because I think, actually, because they were all English at the time, Bush was the hardest situation I had ever had to get into. It was just a completely different language for me, coming from like a metal band to like what is like a grunge rock band, especially at that time. But I had so much experience with dealing with people's vibes. When I went to play with Blur, everyone in the band, including Damon, when I came in to play bass with them in the rehearsal studio, turned their back to me.
Oh my God.
And I was like, and Damon's the sweetest guy in the world. Like, I really love him. But, like, I just think that it was like, so I was like, "All right, let's do this." Because I've been through this many times before.
Yeah,
I'm going to play these songs. And in the middle of the song, everybody started turning around at me and smiling at me. But it was an interesting thing. You know, like, so much about being a professional musician is social.
Yeah. I hear that all the time. Because, you know, everybody says, you know, you got 1 hour to play and 23 hours to not play. And if you don't fucking fit in the 23 hours, you know, no matter how good you are during the one, it's going to be impossible.
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I think that's where people I know a lot of people that are phenomenal guitar players, but they're like bedroom guitar players, and because they're bedroom guitar players, they're socially awkward.
Yeah.
You know, which I can relate to. I spend a lot of time by myself too, but I just think that it's such a huge component. So anyway, I went out and I tried out for those guys. It was in England. And then Gavin and I, right afterwards, we did the Chris Isaak show. We did two episodes. So that was my first performance ever with him. We were on a taped show where we played with Chris Isaak. We played one of Gavin's songs and a Cars song with Chris Isaak's band.
That's cool, man. But you must have been like, when you're out there, God, can't somebody show up for an audition that actually invites me to an audition? God, I could sit. No, I could see. I would be really like, you know, like, cut me, you know, give me a break. You know, because it makes you feel like uncared for. Like, you know, I want to invite you to the audition. I'm not going to be there. What? You know, it's, I totally get that, man. It is kind
of
weird.
I told somebody years later, a good friend of mine, one summer I had off from Helmet, I played bass in a R&B band with a bunch of really good, like, session kind of jazz musicians. And they hired this one kid who's now, like, a really close friend of mine. He was this guy from Manhattan School of Music, total guitar shredder. I was playing bass. And people in the room could kind of sense that he was, you know, like, a little bit unsure of himself, not of his playing, but unsure of himself. And he said something like, you know, I really feel like, you know, he explained his feelings, I guess. And I pulled him outside and I said, listen, bro, I don't know you. I was like, but never share your feelings in a room full of men. I was like, it's like bleeding in a shark tank.
Can't you give me a hug?
I was just like, you're bleeding in a shark tank right now. Just pretend you're confident no matter what you're doing.
Yeah. Oh my God. Wow. That's really cool. So, hey, talk about, you've played with, I want to just talk about some of the people you've played with and how you got the gig, the nature of the engagement. And if you have a cool story, and man, I got to ask you first about Peter Green, because I, you know, who the hell plays guitar and doesn't love Peter Green?
I mean, I think a lot of people don't know who Peter Green is now. Don't you think that? Don't you find that?
Well, younger people, yeah. But I think everybody that's into music that's 50 and up, I got to believe, knows. Or that's into guitar has to know who Peter Green is.
Maybe. I mean, a lot of people that I know who Peter Green is. But I always wonder. Well, in fact, I wonder because when I was staying out with going out to work with Gavin when we were going to do some of his solo stuff, or maybe it was the first band that we put together after Bush, but I was staying with the keyboard player in his band that was in Bush, Sasha Putnam. He's a great guy, phenomenal musician, classically trained. And we were staying in this place where we had a studio. So every night I'd come home after a long day of like demoing stuff with Gavin in the studio. And then he was working with this DJ who was on the BBC called Chris Coco. And every night they'd come in and they'd be like, hey, can you put a little guitar in this? Because neither one of them was a guitar player. I think I'm on like 60 something songs that I never got paid for. Like, you know, like with those dudes that are just out there.
Oh my God.
The Peter Green one was one of them. And they had said, you know, we're working with Peter Green. And I said, that's amazing. And they said, we redid Albatross, but we don't like the guitar sound, because he had brought in Strat. I guess they were expecting him to bring in his Les Paul that he had sold like some time ago. And
he sold to Gary Moore, that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I said, I don't want to replay Peter Green's part. I'm not doing that. I was like, you don't understand as a non-guitar player what you're asking me to do. So I said, but I understood what they wanted, and they basically wanted something that was a little bit more modern and kind of more in what they were, what the music that they were making was like. You know, like Peter Green is one of the greatest blues rock guitar players ever. He like kind of paved the way that people don't know. So he's a giant, you know, like
incredible player.
And so I just added a lot of like soundscape stuff to it, because I refused to to maybe I'm saying I refuse now, like retelling the story in a better way, but I didn't do it. And so that ended up, and I didn't think much about it actually, because I didn't know what it was used for, but it actually ended up on one of the Fleetwood Mac greatest hits, records.
Wow.
Which was like huge to me. So it's like, I never met Peter Green. I didn't really replay Albatross. I just kind of did a bunch of soundscape stuff to a track that they did that was actually really cool. Like what they were doing was cool, and what they were trying to do was very cool. And I really appreciate the opportunity to have been on it, but it like looks different than it is. Like I played on a track with Peter Green that ended up on a Fleetwood Mac greatest hits record. But like, it was just like me coming home from a long night in the studio and like laying down a couple of other guitar tracks and forgetting about it until I saw it in a record store sometime after.
That's wild. Do you know who, you know, you ever heard of Jethro Tull?
Of course. Yeah. I love Jethro Tull.
So I interviewed Martin Barr on Monday, and Martin, he'd done some work with Peter, and I asked him a similar question. He said he's one of the loveliest, you know, his English, he said that's was one of the loveliest human beings I've ever met in my life. He said he was such a nice guy. He said it was just one of the great experiences of his life. And this is a guy who opened up for Hendrix, Zeppelin, Gilmour and Floyd, and Fleetwood Mac. And he said that, you know, he was such a great human being. He said him and Hendrix both, actually. But that's cool, man. So the opposite end of the spectrum, now we go from Orange 9mm, Helmet, Peter Green, Katy Perry. You're like a man of a thousand faces here, man.
Yeah, I worked with, Junior Sanchez is a good friend of mine. He's a big DJ, and he's also a great producer. And there was a time, you know, this was a time when I was just picking up whatever gigs I could. And most of the gigs in New York at that time were on dance tracks, hip hop tracks, and like kind of R&B tracks. So, and Junior and I have a real connection. And I would play bass and guitar and a bunch of stuff that he was doing. I loved working with him. I still love working with him. I would work with him on whatever he was doing. He's a great guy. He's a really great musician. And he was like, we had worked on a bunch of stuff. He was working, I can't remember what label it was, but we were just working with all these artists that were signed to this major label. And he was remixing some stuff with Katie, and they wanted to do a couple of songs with her. And she wasn't anybody. Like, he knew who she was, and there was a buzz about her, about the industry, but she hadn't had a record come out yet, so I didn't know who she was. But I remember, there are very few people that I remember sitting next to and going, like, this person is a fucking star. Like, she, before she was anybody, and she could sing her ass off. That's the other thing about Katy Perry that I don't know if people know. I'm sure fans think this, but I don't know what musicians think, but she's a monster. She is a super talented singer, and she's powerful. Like, she would like turn to me, like she was, you know, like way younger than me, you know, and like she would just turn to me and be like, I think it should be more like this. Very self-assured, not weird about stuff. So I that was one of the people that like I met. I was like, this person's a star. This person's going to be a huge star.
Wow, that's interesting. I was curious about that, actually. Hey, what are you working on now that you got you a little excited?
Musically?
Yeah, musically, personally, whatever.
We have a, you know, we've been kind of, working on the land outside. I guess I'm just excited about the kind of the future. I'm trying to get better at guitar. I realized, you know, like that there's a lot of guitar playing out there. It's like with Instagram, that's such a cool it's such a cool tool. Like, see people, you know, of all different degrees, levels of skill playing guitar and sharing ideas. So trying to get into that world a little bit and find out what people are doing. Checking out scenes that I like really like, but like that I'm not a part of, like shred scenes and stuff like that. And just
are you a shredder, even though you're not a part of that scene? I mean, like, do you like that music?
No.
Okay.
I like the guitar playing. I mean, I like the guitar playing. I think it's hard to I think it's fascinating exercise to try to take stuff like that and put it into music that people that aren't musicians want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's different levels of that. I mean, like, for instance, like growing up, my mom loved Yngwie Malmsteen because I think it was because like he was neoclassical, kind of classical based. But, you know, I think there's a lot of Nashville dudes like Guthrie Trapp, like people that can shred, that kind of like take some of their skills and put them into more mainstream songs. But so that's interesting to me. I'm just really kind of mentally getting prepared to go away for 10 weeks.
Oh, on the R3 tour?
Yeah.
That's a long time, man. Or is that not a big deal?
I mean, it's not, you know, not to get too into personal things, but like my
don't express your feelings.
Yeah, no, my kid is going to college, so when I leave, I won't see her until she gets back for winter break.
Right?
Do you know? So that's tough. A long time to be away from her, and just kind of, you know, it's trying to get my head ready for it, to go into it in a positive way and to be prepared. And I want to put on great shows. Like when you go out there, people pay a lot of money. We have such dedicated fans and people that seem to spend the majority of their expendable income on coming to see us and don't seem like they're the richest people in the world monetarily. And I want to make sure that every show that those people come to is just a great show filled with energy. I don't want anybody to have, I want everybody to walk out of every show, even if you see us 10 times in a row, saying that was great. So to me, I kind of go into this mental preparation state. My family has noticed it too. I start to kind of pull away a little bit, like 2 weeks before I leave, because I'm trying to reserve energy and prepare for what I'm going to be doing. And I want every show to just be great, you know, so I'm dedicated to that. I stop thinking about like what I want as a person and all that kind of stuff and just get dedicated to putting on the best shows that I can. Is that a good answer to the question?
Yeah, totally good. I mean, you're a consummate professional. I can tell that in everything you do. And, you know, the integrity of what you're doing is super important to you. The service of not only to the song and to the musician, but to the audience is really important to you. I mean, that's just a super classy, you know, you're a professional, man. That makes total sense, you know, and it's nice to see that dedication. It's inspiring. You grew up in Queens. What was your childhood like?
So interesting.
That's such a vague, that's like you could run for office with that answer.
Yeah. Well, you know, luckily things have, you don't have to be too squeaky clean anymore to get into office, but
I don't think he ever did.
Yeah, that's true. Actually,
to be honest with you.
That's a good point. I grew up in Queens. You know, I think it was a really interesting time, especially when I was a young kid. Like we didn't live in the greatest neighborhood. My parents wanted me to. My parents. I don't know if they should get in trouble for this, but my parents actually had me lie about where I was from so I could go to a better school. And that they used to think that I was not that smart in my in the school that I was going to, because I couldn't remember my address or my phone number. Like I was the last kid to get it right, because I was remembering somebody else's
something
address.
Something else. Yeah, of course. That's and, fun. Where in Queens did you grow up?
So my dad is from Howard Beach and my mom is from Ozone Park, and I grew up in Rosedale.
Okay. I know Howard Beach is a pretty nice area. I don't know Ozone Park or Rosedale.
It's all by JFK. And at the time I was growing up, it was like a lot of abandoned lots around, because it was an airport. Like
nice.
People that want to build right up close to the airport. And I used to have a walk across like every morning. I don't remember how far it was, but it seemed like it was super far. You know, you're a little kid, everything seems longer and bigger. But I used to walk across abandoned lots with like junkyard dogs and like,
nice.
You know, discarded pornographic magazines and motor oil and like, you know, like it's just like hopping fences to get to school. So and in the 70s they decided one time to shut down the schools because they didn't, for some reason, I can't remember, it was either they didn't have the money or a teacher strike, And you weren't allowed to be out in the street during like school hours because they had what was called truant officers, I think. And you remember that?
Truant officers. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, they used to close. I think they closed the school for Son of Sam, actually, because I was in the Bronx. That's where he was killing a lot of people.
Oh, maybe you're right. Yeah. I don't remember. I just remember that, like, thinking about it now, you know, people don't let their kids do much of anything without, you know, supervision and protection. I was just like walking across abandoned lots with like roaming dogs and stuff, you know, like trying to get to school and lying about my phone number. So that was like my Queens. I think Queens was an interesting time, you know, in the 70s and the early 80s to be living in a place like that. I think there was a lot of tensions between different kinds of people and classes of people. And as a kid, you just don't give a fuck about that.
No.
Like, totally. You'd be friends. I was friends with like all these different kids. You'd play football or baseball with all these different kids, but it seemed like, there was definitely friction between people from different blocks and different neighborhoods, you know.
Did either your parents into music?
No.
How did you get involved in music?
Well, my parents did take me to a Suzuki program. You know the Suzuki music program?
No.
Suzuki was a Japanese teacher. I may be getting this wrong, but I think Suzuki was a Japanese teacher who taught music to children as a language. So it basically learned how to play by ear and communicate through like solfege. And I was in that.
What was that word you just said? Communicate by what?
Solfege. That's how people do the scale. Say the major scale.
And it was solfege. I never heard that.
It's pretty, if you played piano, like growing up, you probably know about it, or violin.
Okay.
And so they took me to that. They tried to, my parents were my friends. They were super cool when I was younger. And, so they took me to that, but they tried to get me to play guitar when I was really young, but it just hurt my hands. So I was like, forget about this. I don't want to do this. So painful to play guitar when you're little, you know, the strings, like to have the hand strength to hold them out. So I didn't play guitar for a while. And it wasn't until like, when I was in junior high school, there was this band of high school graduates that had an Allman Brothers cover band, and they would play One Way Out, you know, the Allman Brothers.
Oh, love it.
And this guy would play slide, and it just did something to me. Like, to see that, I was like, what? I was like, I want to do that. Like, it just felt so good to hear. It was like, felt like drugs.
Yeah.
So I remember that I had my great-grandfather from Brooklyn had a Epiphone arch top that was stored underneath my mom's staircase for years. Didn't have strings on it. I put strings on it and just try to start teaching myself how to play guitar. I got a bunch of Zeppelin records on vinyl. One of my cousins got married, and I guess his wife didn't want him to have all his records. She wanted them to grow up. So he gave me all the Zeppelin records, and I spent a summer indoors teaching myself like Zeppelin riffs on an acoustic arch top.
And it's funny that your parents were like so like encouraged, you know, wanted to take you to music lessons, play guitar, and they weren't musical. That was pretty cool.
I think they were trying to do all the right stuff. They were going through being a parent. I appreciate my parents way more.
Yeah. Are your folks still around?
Yeah.
That's great.
And they're still, not together, but they're still around.
Still live in Queens?
No. No.
So, you're very diverse. I mean, I said this a few times, from Helmet to Katy Perry to Peter Green. Are you like a fan of all these different kinds of musics? Of kinds of musics. That's really good English. Are you a fan of all this different music? And like, what is your favorite music to listen to in your free time? If you even listen to music in your free time?
I'm like a child of the 70s. So I still like, I love like Zeppelin and Neil Young and CSNY and modern guitar players. I like Bill Frisell, and but I have a, you know, a kid, so I listened to a lot of modern music and turned on to a lot of like some of the, what I think is like the better hip hop stuff that's coming out in electronic music. So I like guitar music to play, but I don't really listen to necessarily like straight up guitar music. Mm-hmm. And I just like now that I have more facility on the instrument, most of my free time is spent me playing music, yeah. You know? So like I'll play like on a couple of chord changes and I'll just improvise on chord changes by myself and get lost for hours, which is, I listen to music in the car, I guess. That's, I listen to a lot of reggae music in the car, modern reggae music. But when I'm at home, I'm just playing music. A lot of times I'll wake up, I'll be playing guitar when I'm at home, and my family will come in and I'll be sitting in the dark playing guitar, but I don't realize that I'm sitting in the dark. You know, I
just play the whole time. Yeah.
Yeah.
What were some of the, I mean, you've talked about just trying to figure out who you wanted to be. Were there any other like obstacles that you felt you've had to overcome over your 25 year career in doing music?
I think there are obstacles that everyone encounters. It's hard to tell because I'm not everyone, but when I grew up playing sports. I got a scholarship to school for sports, and
dude, what sport?
Lacrosse.
Yeah, man, that was a big thing in Long Island. Elmont, Long Island. I remember they were huge in lacrosse, right?
We beat those dudes. No, just kidding.
Was that it, Elmont? I don't even know why I know that. It's like a useless fact in my head for some reason.
Yeah, it is. I was just way into sports. I thought I was going to be a professional athlete. But when I was playing, like I played football, it was a curse when I was young. I was a year younger than Jay Fiedler, who ended up starting quarterback for the Miami Dolphins.
Yeah.
And I played quarterback too. So I had the opportunity to see what someone who really is like a professional athlete looks like when you're next to him, like how they play and how much better than they are than other people. But,
he went to your high school.
Yeah. I grew up playing baseball. Jay was a baseball player. I mean, his dad was a professional baseball player.
I didn't know that. That's wild.
I grew up, a lot of my friends' dads were professional baseball players. So we grew up in a pretty competitive baseball place, and I loved baseball. But when I got older, a little bit older, when I got into junior high, and actually from seeing Jay, and being around tournaments and seeing kids who were going to get scholarships to college for baseball and how hard it was for those people to become pro, I switched to lacrosse because I was like, I'm going to go into this sport and I'll be one of the better dudes in that.
Gotcha.
I just thought it was a better opportunity for me. But anyway, growing up playing sports, I always felt like I was too small. And then playing music, I always felt like I was too big. You know, like, so I was like, felt like it wasn't like really the right fit for anything until you get older and you kind of learn to. I remember somebody said to me, like, embrace yourself.
Yeah.
And it's easy to say, very hard to do. And so I guess, the obstacle that I've had to overcome in music, and I think people have to overcome in life, and I would have to have overcome in life anyway, is to embrace myself, like be honest with myself about what I'm good at and what I'm not good at, and just but kind of wholly embrace that. Because I don't think that it wasn't until I was really honest about my faults as a guitar player to myself that I could really start improving on them.
Yeah, I think that's true about anything. You know, you can't fix it until you, admitting you have a problem is the first step, but that's kind of true for anything. You know, you can't fix something unless you acknowledge that it's something that needs to be fixed.
Yeah, for sure. And it's hard to, especially in such an ego-driven business where, you know, like, or in a business where like your job could be taken from you by someone that's better than you, to kind of even admit to yourself that.
Yeah. I could understand that. So if you had to go back and give yourself advice, a younger Chris Traynor, what would you have told yourself, assuming you were willing to listen, that would have made your life easier?
Everything's going to be okay.
I like that. I like that a lot, man.
Thanks.
Let's talk about gear for a few minutes. I mean, I've seen you have some really nice guitars. What is your go-to for right now, and like what other two or three would round out your top?
My live guitar for Bush, the guitar I've been using for quite some time, is a refinished, retopped Dave Johnson restoration. He redoes Les Pauls for a lot of really great guitar players. And he's an amazing luthier. And so he redid that. He redid basically everything on my guitar. He re-glued it. So that's my main guitar. That's the guitar I travel with. I never have that guitar at home because it always stays in a locker and it's kind of like floating around the world going to wherever my next gig is.
What year is this?
It's from the 80s.
Is that the black one I've seen you playing?
The black one was never mine. It was a loaner that I got from Gibson in England, which there are a lot of pictures of floating around with me with that guitar, but I only had it for a year and it was on loan.
What was the guitar you played with Orange 9mm?
That is a guitar that I still have. It's a 1973 Les Paul Custom.
That's a really nice looking guitar.
Well, that guitar I used in Bush as well. I've used that guitar on every record I've ever made, I think, with the bands that I've been in. And my girlfriend at the time had given me the rent check. Or no, it was cash, actually. Cash to go get a check to pay the rent. And I walked past Carmine Street Guitars in New York City.
is great. Go ahead.
And then the guy, I went in there and they had a Les Paul Custom. And I was like, it's so cheap. I think it was $750 or $650. It was the exact amount of money that I had for the rent. And I went in and I knew I shouldn't have done it. But the guy, I was like, I'm going to buy this guitar. And the guy was like, well, there's tax on it. And I was like, all I have is this, you know, this is my rent money. So, I bought that guitar. I still have it. Didn't pay the rent. I can't remember what happened. I remember I got in trouble with a bunch of different people for it, but it was worth it.
Yeah. And it was a different girlfriend, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't matter now.
she's cool for, helping get me that guitar for a number, you know, and for a number of reasons. I'm sure she's cool.
So you got the Dave Johnson Les Paul, the 73 Les Paul Custom. What else?
You know, in my house, I have an SG Junior that's not mine. It's actually my girlfriend's. And I love playing that because it's like a slim body. Like I like Tellies, and I like the way Tellies and Strats, because they're comfortable and they're like kind of lighter, but I'm not comfortable with a Fender scale, scale length. So SG Juniors I find are like really nice, like kind of like kicking around guitars. So those are I have so many different guitars that I've acquired over the years, and I have a bunch of guitars for the Bush gig because, you know, there's 25 years of music.
Yeah.
So sometimes there's different tunings and you need a backup. You know, if you want to be professional, you really do need a backup for whatever guitar you have. And then you end up having like all these guitars that you don't use a lot of the time. But I mainly, if I have my druthers, as they say, I'll get handed that Dave Johnson guitar at the beginning of the set, and then an hour and 45 minutes later, I'll hand it back.
That's really cool. So you're that much into that. You're that bonded with that guitar, I should say.
Yeah. And I like tuning myself. Like I feel like the guitar gets hot, and then, you know, like you get more of a relationship of how the guitar is tuning where you are on stage. And so, you know, like I used to be more of a nightmare when I would just get like raging drunk on stage and just get totally carried away with it. Now in my, my calmer years, I think it's an easy job. I think techs probably get bored. You know, they're just sitting back there and they don't see me for most of the show.
That's great. That 1973, is that weigh a ton? The Les Paul Custom?
It's the reason why I have like a
sciatica.
It's not sciatica. I'm trying to think of what it is. I have,
pinched disc or something.
What's the thing that it's the thing that runs from your knee up until your psoas.
Oh yeah.
So it's like my posture on one side. I remember I was having a lot of, I thought I had a hernia. We went to China and I was having real problems and I thought, oh no, I have a hernia. And I went to a guy and he came to see me on stage. He's like, no, that's why you have the problems. The way you stand with that guitar.
It's a heavy guitar, man.
It's like 10 pounds. It's ridiculous.
Hey, are there any, with respect to your guitars, are there any cool or interesting stories behind how you acquired any of them?
I still have my grandfather's, my great grandfather's Epiphone Archtop, which I've been restoring for a while. And, it always had this hole for the pickup on it. And so but I never knew what kind of pickup was on it. And I just eventually bought, D'Armond's.
Those are the ones that were in those old, harmonies, I think too, right?
Yeah, I guess there were these, the original guitar pickups were because they were aftermarket, right? So a lot of them came with those kind of long metal arms and they would screw onto the body or the pickguard in some fashion. And I just guessed at which one I thought it had and I had it installed. And then a year later, my mom showed me a picture of her and her cousin pretending to be the Beatles with that guitar, and it was the same exact pickup.
Oh, so you nailed it.
Yeah.
I have had so many guys tell me that they have the old Epiphone guitars are just, you know, whether it's electric or acoustic, they're just second to none.
They were a higher quality brand, yeah, for sure. I think that's why Gibson bought them, to kind of put, you know, they were too competitive. The early, you know, it depends on what time period, but the way those Epiphones were being made, the quality was really high and they were futuristic. Like I think, they had more futuristic names. Epiphone seemed to be like a cooler, hipper brand at one point.
Do you ever heard of a guy named Red Volkart?
Yes.
You know, Red, he's a
I met Red when I was a kid.
Did you? How'd you meet Red?
Helmut was playing, gosh, I don't know where Helmut was playing, but we ended up afterwards at a bar that was a boot store that doubled as a bar at night. And there is this, you know, big dude in overalls playing a Telecaster, like doing live covers for people for tips. And he was like shredding and people would go up there totally, totally wasted and like skipping lines or missing beats. And then he would just like pick right up on it. And I was like, I can't believe this guy is doing this. So shredding. This is when he lived in Nashville before. I think he lives in Austin now. I'm not sure.
He does.
That's correct. He's Canadian.
Yep.
And correct. He came up, we stayed late. There was like only a couple of people left. He came over to the table and started talking with us. And he would say stuff. I remember he said, I think you learn everything you know about guitar in the first year that you play. And I was like, gosh, I hope not. You know, but he's so just a killer player and like the sweetest guy. And he was playing. I'm always amazed. I've seen so many people that either ended up becoming famous in the guitar world or were famous and kind of maybe forgotten about, playing in like bars or coffee shops or tips. Like shredders, like people that are like, you know, like I could have 5 lifetimes, 10 lifetimes live, and I would never be as good as they are.
It's pretty so funny that Helmut and Red Volkart in the same sentence, let alone in the same place. That's so fun. He's one of the nicest guys around, and he's actually does a lot of clinics overseas now, and he's pretty successful. He teaches all over the place, and he's a monster. But he's the one who told me, he goes, because he's got a lot of. He's been a guitar collector his whole life and he's made a lot of money buying and selling guitars. And he once told me, he said, listen, I said, yeah, I'd love to have like a vintage 335. Like that's not vintage. That's a 2014. It looks like a vintage one. But anyway, he said, what you ought to do is don't get a vintage Gibson 335. If you find an Epiphone 335, you know, an Epiphone Dot from, or an Epiphone, I think it's a Casino from the 70s. He goes, it'll cost you, you know, it's still expensive. It'll cost you $3,000, $4,000, maybe $5,000, but nothing like the Gibsons will cost you. And he goes, it's a better guitar.
I mean, some of them, that's the thing actually with a lot of vintage guitars, like the ones that became popular, right, are largely because of who played them.
Yeah, man.
And so, like, when people get old enough to be able to afford a guitar of their heroes, they become worth something. And so, same thing is true of, like, Star Wars figures. But, like, to not to go off on a tangent, but so guitars, there are guitars that are considered icon guitars. But the guitars are only considered icon guitars because of the icons that played them.
Yeah.
You know, like, Stratocaster could have well not have been made anymore if Jimi Hendrix didn't play it.
Yeah.
So there are guitars that I think, like, the Les Paul and the Telecaster. You know, like, the Telecaster is an amazing thing because can you imagine, like, that being, you know, people will argue it was or it wasn't, but for all intents and purposes, the Telecaster is the first, like, production soft body electric guitar. And Leo got it right, like, the first time. Like, there's not, you know, people have been trying to improve on that guitar for a while, but really, like, that is the standard. Like, the first thing out of the gate is a great guitar, and I feel that way about the Les Paul. I gravitate towards the Les Paul more, and I gravitate towards the Les Paul because of Jimmy Page. In fact, when I got my Les Paul, I was like, my Les Paul looks small on me, because I didn't realize how small Jimmy Page was.
Wait a minute, Page is small? I thought he was tall guy.
Jimmy Page?
Yeah. He always
I'm not going to say he's a small guy, but he's not my size.
Yeah, but you're really tall.
Well, I thought the guitar would look as big on me as it did on Jimmy Page, but it doesn't.
Oh, because you're you're much taller.
And
that's wild.
So there's what I was going to say is that because I also made ends meet a lot of years by just buying and selling vintage guitars. I helped start one store in New York City, and I used to work at Chelsea Secondhand Guitars in New York City, which is a pretty famous vintage guitar store. And there are, like, for instance, there are a lot of guitars that were more expensive and maybe fancier, let's say, than Gibsons and Fenders, that made very similar guitars that came into the market late because people were guitar became so popular that there weren't enough guitars out there to fill the need. So they're like fancy, like Guild Firestars, I think, you know, and somebody write in and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they were more expensive than the ES Gibson series. They were fancier. They had fancier binding, certainly the top of the line ones. So, and those are pretty solid guitars, but they're not they're not as valuable because they weren't played, you know, they don't appear to be icon guitars because of who played them. Like Alvin Lee played, right? Didn't Alvin Lee play a 335 at Woodstock?
335. Yeah. That's all he played ever.
I actually played that guitar.
How does that? That's pretty cool.
I don't want to give up who owns it, but I know somebody who owns it, who bought it as like a collector, kind of like fan. I don't know if it's public knowledge, but I did get a chance to play it, and the guitar is incredible. And I don't know if I was like, sometimes you pick up something and it has like a history like that and something and you're like,
I can feel it. I can feel it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I can feel the vibes, but it is an incredible guitar. So you have guitars like that where people just view it as being part of history. And so that's why they're more expensive, but I don't know that they're necessarily better guitars.
Yeah, that is true. It's funny. Martin Barr mentioned Alvin Lee, and he said he was, and I'm not speaking out of school because he said this on the show. He said he was quite a difficult person to get along with. Oddly enough.
I don't know him.
Yeah. It's another useless fact I know. who influenced you that people might be surprised to hear?
Well, I think I say a lot that Jimmy Page influenced me, but there's a guitar player in a DC hardcore band called Brian Baker. He was in Dag Nasty, and I think he ended up playing he ended up playing in some metal band that wasn't glam metal band called Junkyard, and then I think he plays guitar now in Bad Religion. But growing up, he was I looked I liked the way he played because he was someone that was playing in the hardcore punk rock scene that was seemed a little bit more technical.
Mm.
And he had a cool sound on the Fugazi records to me as a kid. That's what I thought. And I liked Robert Fripp's outlook on life.
I don't know much about him. I mean, I know some of his ambient stuff or ambient, whatever you call it, but what was his outlook?
I think it would be treacherous for me to try to explain it, but he's really into some esoteric stuff that I found really interesting as like a peripheral to guitar and a way to live, but I wouldn't be the person to dare to explain it.
Where is that online somewhere?
I mean, you can look. He has this thing called Guitar Craft, which I went to one of them, which is really interesting. Kurt Golden is one of the teachers in that, and he's an amazing guitarist and an amazing teacher. And there's a whole methodology behind how they play, how they tune, how they sit. They have an Alexander technique teacher, massaging your posture, correcting your posture as you're playing. But it's an interesting way to look at life and the guitar.
I just wrote that down. Thanks. Matt Umanov's gone.
No, I didn't know that. Really?
Yeah. It closed about, I don't know, a year ago, 6 months to a year ago. There's not many guitar shops left in the city. I mean, Guitar Center on 14th Street, but there's not a lot of independent shops left. You have just a small handful.
Crazy.
Yeah, man. What was the first CD you ever purchased, if you remember? Or vinyl?
My parents tried to force Kiss on me when I was a kid, but I didn't buy those records. I think the first records that I listened to were my mom's Beatles singles, 45, mm-hmm. and then I was way into the Beatles, so like heavily influenced by my parents. And the first tape I ever bought, I think, was the first thing I bought for myself, was Sgt. Pepper's.
You know, it's interesting. When I talk to guys that are in their like 60s or 70s, the thing that turned them onto music was seeing the Beatles on TV. Like almost 100% of them were like, I knew I needed to be in a band after that. When I talk to guys that are sort of like 10 years younger than that, like in my age bracket, a lot of them got turned onto music by Kiss.
I mean,
a huge preponderance.
Everyone that I knew growing up that was into rock music, and a lot of people that I know now as adults, they're like mega Kiss fans.
Yeah.
It just like wasn't like it. I get it now. Do you know what I'm saying? But as a kid, it never appealed to me.
Nah, it's music, man. You know, it's vanilla and chocolate, you know, and strawberry, sure. You know, no, I totally get it. But it's I was shocked because I didn't realize Kiss had influenced so many people, but I can't tell you how many guys have. You know, I heard Kiss and I started playing. What do you like most about yourself, man? That's a tough question.
Whoa.
I know. Went from Kiss to that.
Do I have to find something? No. I'm pretty disciplined when I want to be.
That's important.
And I think when I set my mind to doing something, I'm pretty good at keeping my promise to myself.
Yeah, discipline is a very overlooked, important thing, man. It's critical to accomplishing anything, I think. In fact, I read a book, a business book, and it's a pretty famous book, and I can't think of who, but the guy did a study of like the top companies, and then one characteristic that all of them had contributed towards the success was the fact that they were disciplined.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I read recently that successful people make their bed every morning. So I started to make my bed, but then I realized – I still make my bed, but then I realized really successful people have someone make their bed for them.
How about the flip side, man? If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
I made a list on paper of things that I want to change about myself, but I don't think I'm at a place where I could share that publicly.
No, that's all good.
You can put that in the interview.
Yeah, it's all good.
I just don't, I just, I know there are things that I've written down that I'd like to change about myself, but I don't think there are things that I'm prepared to share publicly.
Totally cool, man. No, I think that's great that you write it. I think it's good that you write stuff down. Like, I think it's just important to write, you know, I write down stuff I need to do to get done. I think it's just as important. You write stuff about yourself that you need to get done, you know? Best childhood memory besides walking across the empty lots.
My mom and my dad just told a funny memory that I remember a little bit. Was I don't know if it's the best memory, but it's the most recent funny one. Whereas my dad, who's a pretty handy guy, was on the roof of our house in Queens, and he had a ladder up there on the weekend, and I kept climbing up the ladder while he was trying to retile the roof with shingles, and he kept putting me down and saying, "You can't come up here." And I kept climbing up, you know, I was like 6 years old. I kept climbing up the ladder. And so my dad didn't have anybody watch me. And so he took me up on the roof. He tied me around the chimney and gave me a hammer and a nail to bang into wood on the roof. And, so that I wouldn't go anywhere. And my neighbors called my mom to complain that my dad had tied a kid around the chimney.
That's great.
My dad said he's totally safe. So I remember that. I think about that and I smile.
That's a very cool story, man. If you didn't become a professional guitar player, man, what do you think you would have done?
Part of me thinks I'd be lost, but another part of me feels like that I'm an artist, and that sounds so pretentious, even when it's like coming out of your mouth to say, but I feel like I would be some kind of art.
Some other creative pursuit.
I really like writing, actually, and I never do it. I hope someday to get around to writing more. So maybe a writer, hopefully something creative.
This should be interesting. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd. Come on, Chris, you've been full of surprises.
Well, I just don't know. I don't know if people know me. So when you feel like people don't know you, then they can't be surprised by something. I have two separate lives. You know, I have the life that I go out and tour, and I have a lot of clothes that I wear on tour, and it's so and rituals that I have on tour that are different than my home life. So I think a lot of that, not necessarily surprising, but would be different about how people think about me. But I have I have a closet and a dresser, and the dresser I keep all my cool, quote unquote, like rock tour clothes in, and it's a cool looking dresser. It's made out of metal. And then my closet I call the dad zone, where I put all like my stuff when I doing work around the house or just kicking around or kind of going to the gym. But I think people don't know me, but it's fair enough to say that like I'm just kind of still discovering myself.
No, that's a cool answer. And that makes total sense. I mean, you're not going to dress the same way on stage as you are, you know, driving your daughter to school. Well, she probably drives herself at this point, but you know what I'm saying?
Some people do. But yeah, in LA, some people do. I'm always surprised about that. But
yeah, someone's in the bakery in a big floral shirt. I could see that.
Yeah, pirate shirt.
Yeah. Chris, who inspires you?
Bob Rock has really influenced me. When I came in to do the Wanderlust record with Gavin, the solo record, Gavin really wanted me to play in the record with him, because he's like, we're like brothers, and he always sticks up for me and he looks out for me and he feels comfortable around me. But the label didn't want me to play on that record because they said I was too hard of a guitar player, because you know I played in helmets, so that's they kind of whittled me down to being a heavy metal guitar player.
And of course that's all you could do.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like, how dumb is that?
And I went in there and they actually had another guitar player on hold. I was aware of it. Like, they were like, well, we'll see how it goes, you know, like, and I went in there for like the pre-production stuff, which they were recording. And that's when I met Bob, and like, just like watching his approach on music and seeing how open-hearted he was and all the stuff that he kind of taught me. And we've become friends over the years, and the kind of advice that somebody that's not only that talented and creative, but also has worked with so many talented and creative artists can impart to another person. And he, you know, the things that I've learned from him, have been a huge influence on me recently. And it's just been a kind of a blessing to be able to not only work with somebody like that, and but to be able to become friends with them. And we have fun working together, at least I think so. And he, every once in a while, he'll hire me to go up to Canada and work on some records that he's working with. And every time, it's like a journey and an experiment. And I learn a lot about myself and about music. And he's just so knowledgeable and knows so much, and is also so humble and gracious for somebody that's, you know, if you think about how many records that dude has been a part of.
Oh yeah.
You know, and then just to show you like little tricks. And so now that I know him, I'll be like, how did you do that sound in that record? Or like, how did you get that drum sound? And it's amazing to know that kind of stuff, because people talk about that stuff, and people think a lot of it is EQ, but then you learn that it's just the stuff. Like, really, like, if you want to get at the guitar sound of a certain person, obviously some part of it is the person in their hands, but another big part of it is the equipment, you know, like, and when you get the right equipment, that you're closer to getting the right sound. And if you have the wrong equipment and you're trying to like reshape the sound. So that's been hugely influential on me.
Very cool, man. Do you have any non-musical superpowers?
Yes.
That you could share?
No.
You teased. That's not good, man. You mentioned your girlfriend a couple of times, man. You guys have been together a really long time. I just want to say congratulations. I think that's really cool.
Thanks. She makes it easy.
Yeah. She's got to be in the room.
She is in the room. She's making bacon right behind you, buddy.
No, man, congratulations. That's a tough thing to be, you know, not just for a musician, for anybody, man. And that communication is just, you got to constantly hone that down. At least we did.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with any relationship, even with bands and stuff, like, people make mistakes. And if you stick with it and you forgive, because, and then you communicate and you work on that. But also there's like a component that has nothing to do with us. It's like luck.
And yes.
So blessings, divine intervention.
Mm-hmm. No, but I believe that.
We can't take, you know, like, I never want to be seen as taking credit or responsibility for the good things in my life. I worked with it, but there's something else going on.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I totally agree with you. That's what people say to me sometimes, because we've been together so long. They say, how did you do it? I'm like, man, I have no idea. Lucked out a lot. A lot of hard work, but a lot of luck. Because a lot of people work hard and it doesn't work out. Any bad habits that you could talk about?
Bad habits. Let's see. Sybil, what are my bad habits?
I don't know. You leave your socks balled up.
I leave my socks balled up on the floor, but the cat likes them. I try to, I'm pretty disciplined, as I said earlier. So I'm disciplined with my diet, my exercise, and my practice. My bad habit is kind of falling out of it. I think sometimes I suffer with a little bit of depression. So that'll kind of take the wind out of my sails for keeping my good habits up. And I can, and just remember that, somebody once told me that, this was in reference to meditation, and I don't want anybody to think that I meditate. So I'm not like painting a picture of myself as something that I'm not, but somebody once told me that when you're meditating and something happens to take you out of it, we feel like we have to start over. But you don't really have to start over. You can just pick up from where you left off. And I think about that in terms of the things that I'm working towards. Sometimes in life, all of us, things are going well for us, and then we get knocked off course. And we think, shoot, I have to start over. It's so much work. But actually, if you can just get back to where you were and start from there. And so I know in some places that sounds unrealistic, and some people may listen to that and say that it's BS and that sounds privileged. But I actually think with the majority of things that I deal with in life, when I get knocked off, I just got to start from where I leave off. And also that's a part of, remember earlier I was talking about the frustration of dealing with artists that I thought would be really successful and they weren't.
Yeah.
And you don't know why. I stopped viewing those things as failures and started viewing them as part of the work that I needed to do to be successful.
Yeah.
So I try not to view anything too much in a negative light, because I'm real good at looking at things in a negative light if I let myself go. And so I just think of things as, this is the road to success. This is the road to my goals, to what I envision.
I totally get that, because I look at things like I used to look at things, and now I just say, I don't know why it happened, but it's going to lead me on to the next adventure, and now it's time to get to that adventure, you know, whatever, something like that. I mean, it doesn't matter why it happened or why it didn't happen either when it comes down to it, unless it's something directly, well, I caused this, you know.
I think about like injury. Like we've talked a little bit, you and I did, we talked on the phone I agreed to do this interview, and we were talking about exercise a little bit. And I think about injury though. I try to look at injury as to why it happened, what caused it, and what does it mean? Like, cause it could mean that, like, because diet and exercise and lifestyle is something that is supposed to continue on. So what am I doing that's stopping me from being able to go forward in that way? And sometimes I do look for a message in that. I don't look for a message in other people's actions, but when things happen to me, I try to go, you know, why did that happen? What did I do to make that happen? How can I avoid that in the future? But not in terms of, I know people do that in an emotional sense about other human beings, and I try not to do that.
No, you can't account for someone else what the hell they're doing. That's crazy. It's not possible. Hey, man, I'm going to ask you two more questions, and I really appreciate your time. You've been really generous and really kind and very sharing, and I thank you. Any hobbies or interests outside of music? If you have any time, I don't know if you do have time for that.
I love my dog.
There you go.
I just like, he's the greatest dog ever. He's one of my best friends. I talk to him. I spend, you know, because my family travels two separate of me, so I spend a lot of time alone with the dog.
Hmm.
And I gave him a voice, and I talked to him, and we have conversations. So people think I'm super weird when they see me out in the trail and I'm having like a conversation with two different voices with my dog.
Hmm.
Is that something you should admit publicly?
No, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like my dog is 15, and I talk to her every day now because I want her to know that, you know, how important she is to me. And I know she's not going to be around. You know, I hope she'll be around long, but I, you know, not likely. I see her getting old and stuff like that. So no, I actually talk to myself, to be honest with you, when I'm, like if I'm down, or if I'm thinking about something negative and I know it's ridiculous, I'll just say, Craig, what are you doing? And I literally talk to myself because I could talk myself out of thinking something, you know what I'm saying? So no, I don't think that's weird at all.
Cool, man. I'm glad we meet there as well.
Yeah, I mean, who's the hell to say what's weird? If it works and it makes you feel good, great, you know.
that's true. Another thing Bob said that's along those lines is like, if it has a vibe and people think it's good, then it's good. And I think that's really good advice about music. People always say to me about their music, they're like, can you listen to this and tell me what you think about it? And I always think it's like, you know, like, I don't know. I don't want to criticize somebody else's music, but if it has a vibe and you think it's good and you have a vibe for it, then it's good. Like whether other people are going to like it, you can never tell.
Man, last question. And again, thank you so much, Chris. What's been biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years? And how much of that change has been deliberate and intentional? And how much is just a part of aging?
It's hard to separate, right?
Depends.
I don't really, it'd be rare, if ever, that I drink before a show anymore. And I used to do that all the time. That's how I existed. In fact, when I first stopped drinking before shows, I didn't know if I would be able to do it anymore. And I stopped drinking because actually I started eating in a certain way that alcohol wasn't a part of it. Hmm. So it wasn't because I was in AA or anything like that, which I think is totally cool. I was just, I have a different relationship with it. And, so I stopped drinking and I noticed that, it changed, certainly my relationship with the shows, kind of had me concentrate more on what I was doing, changed my relationship with my tech, which was always good. My tech, Brian Herb, who's been with me for a long time. And I never drank at home. So that didn't, I would come home and usually not really drink. But it did allow me to start seeing that where I am adding to a situation to make it worse. Now, I'm not saying that I no longer make situations worse, but I think I'm in the back of my head, I'm recognizing it. I think that has to do with old age.
Watch it.
Yeah. Scratch that out of the interview. Yeah. No, I think that has to do with getting older and kind of seeing myself and taking responsibility for certain things that I do when I can see them, and not taking things on board when, you know, because when you travel around with a band and stuff, sometimes you're doing things that like are making it less pleasant. And then sometimes other people are doing things that are making it less pleasant, but they're making it about you, you know, still. And so to be able to kind of go like, I'm going to try my best to make this as pleasant as possible for me and the people around me, and take responsibility for when I see that I'm doing stuff that's not cool, and not take it on board when people are either blaming me or doing something that's not cool, and taking that into my life, like not getting so hung up on what other people think of me or what I do. And there's a freedom to that, because you start to discover, so we hide so much from ourselves, and we deprive ourselves so much based on what we think people will think, or how we think other people will perceive us. And so I think that's a combination of things. And that has to do with a lifestyle change, and just watching myself as the years go on.
Good for you, man.
Was that clear?
Yeah,
that clear?
But it also refers back to something you said earlier about a lot of the decisions that people sometimes make are based on the community that you want to be in.
Yeah, I think that, you know, like when I was growing up, everyone used to say, well, when I was in my early 20s, everyone was like, I love Sonic Youth, but like none of them had Sonic Youth records. They just thought it made them sound cool, you know?
Yeah, that's a very good example of that. Man, I can't thank you enough. You're a hell of a nice guy, and you're super transparent, man. So thank you very much. I appreciate you keeping this shit real, that's for sure.
Thanks. I hope you got something good, and I enjoyed laughing with you. I hope that I don't bore other people, but I just it was a fun conversation, and thank you for being like so relaxed and open. It was a good conversation.
Likewise, man. Let me tell people where they could find you. First of all, it's Chris Traynor, Traynor. He's a tremendous guitar player, and they're getting ready to kick off the Revolution 3 tour. It's Bush, Stone Temple, Pilots, and The Cult. That'll be in July, and go to bushofficial.com to find out where to get tickets and come say hi to Chris. Well, you can't really say hi to Chris because he'll be up on stage, but support Chris. He's a great player, and he's got a great work ethic, and he's put his heart and soul into working with Bush and Gavin for a long time. And you could check him out online if you or on social media on Instagram at CT3 as in Chris Trainer 3 guitar. And he posts some cool stuff. And that's it, man. Any final words of wisdom?
No, man. Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing people out there. And also I love when other guitar players like communicate with me and comment on my stuff. And they, you know, like we interact. It's a fun new world for guitarists and music fans.
And eat your bacon.
Yeah. That's not mine. It's my girlfriend's.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks very much to Chris Trainer for keeping shit real and for spending all this time with us. I really appreciate it. Thank you, brother. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com, sign up to get on our newsletter, and most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, and I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.